Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Much of the language today around the death of Osama bin Laden invoked closure. The world is safer, said President Obama. It's finally done, said the headlines. But there are as many questions as answers today, including where the money trail goes now that Al-Qaeda's fundraiser-in-chief is no more. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, a mutual life insurance company owned by its members and policyholders. Learn more at massmutual.com/mutuality. And by Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Monday. It is the second day of May. It was apparently pure detective work that led to last night's news of the death of Osama bin Laden at the hands of an American military team, the culmination of a nearly 10-year hunt for the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks. In that time, blood and treasure have poured from the U.S. into two wars and countless security measures. And now, questions of what bin Laden's death means for future financing of the war on terror. Joining us is Stuart Levy, former Undersecretary of Terrorism and Financial Intelligence at the Treasury Department. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about both sides of the financing coin here. First, what does bin Laden's death mean for the financing of terrorist operations? How instrumental was he personally with his personal fortune and then his ability to raise funds because of who he was?
There was a myth that he was funding al-Qaeda out of his personal fortune, but that really was a myth. But he was a very, very important fundraising symbol for al-Qaeda, and his death will be a very significant blow to al-Qaeda's ability to raise money around the world, both in terms of inspiration, but also, interestingly, in terms of authentication. Because one thing that al-Qaeda has had to do in order to raise money in Gulf countries in particular, as more pressure has been put on al-Qaeda, is they've had to send fundraisers who can authenticate that they are actually representing bin Laden and al-Qaeda. And with the loss of bin Laden, I think that that sort of fundraising will become more difficult and complicated.
When you say that it will be a significant effect, can you quantify that at all? I mean, how key was he?
It remains to be seen how key he was. So what's happened in the last few years is that al-Qaeda's finances have been put under significant pressure. There was a tremendous crackdown on al-Qaeda facilitation in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere in the Gulf. Also, there was the death of Sheikh Saeed, who was, we thought, the number three official in al-Qaeda and who was thought to be the chief financial officer. That happened in May of 2010. So the combined loss of Sheikh Saeed with the loss of bin Laden could be tremendously painful to al-Qaeda from a financial perspective.
Well, here in the U.S., bin Laden has really been the rallying figure for spending money on the war on terror. How does his death now affect our willingness to spend blood and treasure in a continuing effort?
Well, you know, it's hard to say today. I mean, today I think everyone is focusing on the success of the operation. I hope people are focusing on how lucky we are to have the kinds of government servants who carried out this very, very brave operation. But over time, I think people will take a look at the impact on the overall fight against terrorism, and what they'll realize is that this doesn't eliminate the threat. There are still organizations that threaten us. There is al-Shabaab in Somalia, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen, and we've seen, unfortunately, over the last few years that those organizations pose a real threat to us here in the United States.
What effect, if any, do you think this will have on, you know, what has been a global effort? Is there any concern at this point that you may lose some of the cooperation of other nations?
Well, I would be speculating, of course, Tess, but I hope that people realize that this is just one person. The hard work that was done to build up this global coalition and the kind of cooperation that has developed both on the tactical level and between individual agencies around the world, as well as at high levels of government, it would be a real shame if that kind of cooperation didn't continue. The loss of bin Laden is a reason to continue cooperating as opposed to a reason to stop cooperating.
Stuart Levy was the Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence under both the Bush and Obama administrations. He's currently with the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you so much for taking the time with us today.
Thank you.
The country where bin Laden had been hiding out has received more than $18 billion in U.S. aid since 2002. In 2009, Congress approved another five-year package of development aid for Pakistan. In return, Pakistan was supposed to help in the war against terror. Now that we know bin Laden was living within miles of Pakistan's military academy, questions are being raised about whether U.S. financial support should come with more strings attached. Marketplace's John Dimsdale has that story from Washington.
It turns out that for several years, bin Laden was living in relative luxury in a compound built especially for him near a major Pakistani military installation. Today, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Michigan's Carl Levin, said Pakistan's leaders will have to answer how the world's number one terrorist was able to hold out there for so long.
I hope that the president of Pakistan, Hardari, will follow through and ask some very tough questions of his own military and his own intelligence. They got a lot of explaining to do.
Some in Congress are asking whether the U.S. should carry through with its multi-year package of development aid for Pakistan's military, as well as for schools and power plants. Professor Layla Hudson at the University of Arizona says bin Laden's killing should make us rethink the U.S.-Pakistan relationship.
We have been feeding the hand that bites us.
Hudson says Pakistani leaders have long used the presence of terrorists to keep aid flowing, with no interest in actually catching them. But Michael O'Hanlon at the Brookings Institution says the U.S. has no alternative.
The way I describe it is that we're in a bad marriage, but we don't have any right of divorce. We don't have any option of divorce. We have too many common security interests.
Interests like fighting the Taliban in Afghanistan and keeping Pakistan's nuclear arsenal in the hands of moderates. At the Center for Global Development, Nancy Birdsall says aid shouldn't be thought of as a reward for good behavior.
Aid does not buy love. It does not even provide leverage, frankly.
Birdsall says aid should be considered an investment over the long run for a stable, more prosperous Pakistan.
And certainly it's an investment that's worth making if it reduces the risk of spending billions later on security or on military intervention.
In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
After a post-death announcement bounce early in the day, Wall Street ended down just slightly. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Today, Southwest Airlines closed its deal to buy rival discount carrier AirTran. It's the third big airline merger in the U.S. in recent years and gives Southwest new destinations like Atlanta and the Caribbean. But Southwest may have to win over loyal AirTran flyers while keeping prices low. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
The single biggest reason for Southwest to buy AirTran? Atlanta. The lucrative hub has been ruled by Delta for decades, and AirTran is already established there. Industry analyst Robert Mann says that alone was worth the price of admission for Southwest.
How does one penetrate the Delta veil over Atlanta? With this acquisition, they actually managed to do that. I think it's likely that Atlanta will be the largest city on Southwest's network within 2 to 3 years.
But aviation consultant Mike Boyd says Southwest has its work cut out for it in Atlanta.
Honestly, Delta Airlines is probably thrilled with this.
Boyd says that's because Southwest fares tend to be higher than AirTran's, and Delta may be able to lure away loyal AirTran flyers who don't like Southwest's no-frills experience.
AirTran has given seat selection. Southwest does not. AirTran has a premium cabin for business travelers. Southwest does not. They're getting an airline that has a very strong brand loyalty, and Southwest is going to have to do things to make sure they keep that brand loyalty.
This is the first high-profile merger of low-fare carriers, and analyst Robert Mann says that it comes at a tough time for discount airlines, as big carriers like Delta and United have emerged from bankruptcy leaner and meaner.
Many of these network carriers came out of restructuring with much lower cost structures. The squeeze was definitely on the low-fare community.
And high fuel prices are squeezing both airline profits and passengers' travel budgets. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
And a quick update to a story we brought you Friday about the white iPhone and allegations of weight gain in the newest line of eye gadgetry. We, along with lots of other news organizations, said it was 0.2 millimeter fatter than its black counterpart, potentially wreaking havoc on case makers. Leave it to Consumer Reports to whip out a ruler and determine that, in fact, there is no size difference whatsoever. In December, President Obama signed legislation repealing the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. Many elite colleges and universities, especially law schools, had opposed the policy. And over the years, they found ways to keep military recruiters and groups like the Reserve Officer Training Corps off campus. But only one school actually took a financial hit for doing so. And now it's hoping that financial pain will end with the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Marketplace's Janet Babin has that story from Vermont.
The Barrister's Bookshop at Tiny Vermont Law School has got to be the hoppinest establishment in sleepy South Royalton, Vermont. And it's only got one noontime customer buying up some essentials for his internship applications.
Where are you applying to?
Every federal district court judge in the Northeast.
Wow.
South Royalton is remote. Central Vermont, more mountains and blue sky than buildings and people. And though it appears quiet, this bucolic hamlet is actually a hotbed of civil disobedience. It's home to one of just two law schools in the nation that has kept up an official decades-long protest against the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. Dean Jeffrey Shields at Vermont Law School calls the federal policy discriminatory, and he says the law school is obliged to take a stand.
The most important role it can take is speaking truth to power. To speak up about values within the institution is a wonderful message to the students.
Initially, lots of law schools agreed. Like Vermont, they banned military recruiters from campuses. Then something changed. Vermont Law School professor Greg Johnson explains.
Congress got wind of this and forwarded an amendment to the Defense Department authorization bill, which would prevent schools who refuse to allow the military to recruit on campus from applying for certain federal funds.
Suddenly, banning military recruiters meant giving up millions in federal money. And just as quickly as they'd kicked them out, schools let military recruiters back in. Harvard Law School, for instance, relented after it realized the university could have lost more than $300 million in federal funds. Dean Shields says the financial stakes were proportionately just as high for Vermont Law School.
On average, it probably costs the law school about $500,000 a year, which for us, with a total budget at that time of about $20 million, was not insignificant.
Shields says computer software upgrades in the IT department suffered the most. But part of what it lost in federal grant money, the school did pick up in national street cred for its stance. Daniel Miller spent 4 years in the Army. Now he's in his third year at Vermont Law School, drawn here by the school's military recruiting ban.
It was one of the things that appealed to me about the school, that I do believe it's a principled stance to take. And indeed, the school sacrifices something for that.
Some students and alumni complained about the policy, but the law school finds itself in the context of the place where it is, in the state of Vermont, was at the forefront of the women's rights movement and leads on gay and lesbian issues, too. Many students here, like Mary Beth Blauser and Danielle Watson, favor the ban.
I mean, I think it's a very brave policy stance.
I don't think that it's something that we all sit around and talk about weekly, but we all kind of know about it, and usually it's a sense of pride, if anything else.
Vermont Law School is eager to welcome military recruiters back to campus, but all will not be forgiven when the policy ends.
Some professors here resent those bigger law schools that ditched the ban and took federal money. Again, here's Professor Greg Johnson.
At the time Vermont Law School banned the military from recruiting, our endowment was $20 million. When Harvard Law School allowed the military back on campus, Harvard's endowment was $30 billion. It seems to me that if we could do it, others could too.
Harvard University's endowment back then was actually closer to $18 billion, but still far greater than Vermont law schools. Before Don't Ask, Don't Tell takes effect, military officials have to certify that it won't hurt the troops' ability to fight. That's expected to happen by summer. When it does happen, Dean Shields will be ready. He's eyeing a few federal grants that'll help fortify the law school's 2012 budget. In South Royalton, Vermont, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Coming up, putting people in homes to get them sold.
They have to be willing to keep the home show ready. They have to be willing to leave the home on 30 minutes notice.
But first, let's do the numbers. After opening higher on news of Osama bin Laden's death, markets wilted a tad. The Dow lost 3 points, less than a tenth of a percent, to end at 12,807. The Nasdaq shaved off 9 points, a third of a percent, to finish at 2864. The S&P 500 took off 2 points, one-tenth of 1%, to close at 1361. Hospital operator Community Health Systems upped its bid for Tenet Healthcare today. Community Health fell 1 2/3%. Tenet shed 3.5%. Dish Network dished up 19% today. The company more than doubled its first quarter profit, settled patent litigation with EchoStar and TiVo. TiVo beamed up 3%. EchoStar fell more than 5%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Manta.com, providing an online destination for small businesses to be found and to find new customers. More online at Manta.com. And by Progressive Insurance, with Snapshot, a program in which rates are determined by the driving habits of policyholders. Learn more at Progressive.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Senate Commerce, Science, and Technology Committee reviews America's natural disaster preparedness and response plans. President Obama honors the National Teacher of the Year, delivering remarks from the Rose Garden. And automakers are scheduled to release U.S. sales figures for April. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. There was another blockbuster merger announcement in the pharmaceutical industry today. Israel-based Teva, the world's biggest maker of generic drugs, will acquire Cephalon for almost $7 billion. While the merger itself is big news, it also plays into another industry story that's gaining more and more attention, and that is a growing shortage of some very common prescription drugs. And doctors and nurses across the country are scrambling to find substitutes. Rob Stein covers the issue in today's Washington Post and joins us now. Good to talk to you.
Hi, Tess. Nice to be here.
So, how did this happen?
It sort of varies from drug to drug, but the main trend that is driving this is that there's been a consolidation in the pharmaceutical industry, where a lot of companies that have been making some of these mainstay drugs have dropped out, essentially. And now there are only two or three manufacturers for a lot of these really important drugs. And that puts you in a situation where if something happens, where if you have a manufacturing problem, if you can't get some raw materials, it very quickly spirals into a shortage.
And you're calling them mainstay drugs. From the article, it does sound like these are drugs that are familiar to most of us and certainly in wide use. Give us an idea of which drugs we're talking about.
Yeah, we're talking about some very, very commonly used drugs. For example, morphine. Norepinephrine is the drug that doctors use in the emergency room when they're trying to stabilize trauma patients, for example. There's also been shortages in several cancer drugs that are used to treat cancer. That's actually one of the cancer drugs that's created the most alarm and the most concern. It's called cytarabine, and it's used to treat several forms of leukemia and lymphoma, and it's been in acutely short supplies to the point where patients who desperately need it can't get it.
Well, so talk to us about what you're hearing in terms of how these shortages are actually affecting the treatment programs for patients.
Pharmacists and hospitals around the country are just basically scrambling constantly to keep up with it. They're checking, you know, their emails every day, and they're learning about new shortages. They're sort of hunting around for supplies. They're having to turn to buyers that are somewhat shady or charging exorbitant prices, or maybe even trying to peddle counterfeit drugs. There's this case in Alabama, which is a very tragic case, where 19 people became ill and at least 9 died because the solution that they were being used in their feeding tubes had become contaminated with a bacterium because the pharmacy that made it was using a substitute that they weren't familiar with because there was a shortage of the ingredient that they usually use.
Wow. Now, in your article, some industry officials blame the FDA in part for the shortages. Why is that?
Several people I talked to in industry have said that they think that it is one of the factors that is contributing to these shortages. The FDA has become much more vigilant about enforcing safety guidelines and making sure that the drug supply is safe. And when the FDA comes in and finds a problem and shuts down a production line, you know, it's one of the things that can cause a shortage to occur.
What's the solution here? What are the FDA and Congress doing to try to get more drugs into the market? Make sure this doesn't happen again.
Yeah, there's several things going on. One thing that's happening is there's been some legislation introduced in Congress. For example, legislation would require companies to simply notify the FDA when anything happens that might cause a shortage. One of the things the FDA has been doing to try to deal with some of these shortages is simply finding companies overseas and allowing them to import the drug into the United States. There are other companies, other manufacturers elsewhere where the drug is available, and they can bring it in if they just have enough time to arrange that.
Rob Stein is a national science reporter for The Washington Post, focusing on health and medicine. Rob, thanks for talking to us.
Nice to be here.
Hundreds of thousands of homes in this country are somewhere in the foreclosure process. They've received notice of foreclosure or they're awaiting final seizure and sale by the bank. Once that happens, the house can sit vacant for weeks, months, or longer. And that, of course, contributes to lower home values throughout a neighborhood, making it even harder to sell that house. Now, some enterprising banks are filling foreclosed homes with what you might call human props. From WPLN in Nashville, Blake Farmer reports on live-in home staging.
Most realtors will tell you a furnished house is easier to sell. That's why there's a whole home staging industry, complete with a show on HGTV.
Staging is about selling homes fast and for top dollar.
It's making people really want to live here.
Instead of moving in a love seat, a few paintings, and an area rug, Bert Lyle's company, called Show Homes, just finds someone to live in the house, and he actually charges that person rent.
You do get weird looks occasionally when it's first presented, but the truth is, it is a better program, in our view, all the way around.
Another company could give the illusion a home is lived in, but Bert Lyles contends live-in staging's a cheaper way to get the job done. Finding the home managers, as he calls them, is the hard part. They need their own high-end furniture, and they have to make their bed every day.
They have to be willing to keep the home show ready 7 days a week. They have to be willing to leave the home on 30 minutes notice. So if you're not a neatnik, this might not be the program for you as a home manager.
Hi, Blake. Come on in.
Good to meet you.
Therese Baker Bell and her two daughters live in this 4,000-square-foot home in a wealthy suburb of Nashville, at least for the moment. This is her second show homes rental, and she estimates the arrangement saves her $1,000 a month.
I'm organizing my stuff.
Sayla, the 6-year-old, is still rearranging her toys, including the pots and pans of her play kitchen. Downstairs in the real kitchen, the granite counters are spotless. The hardwood floor is clean enough to eat off of. Baker Bell relocated from St. Louis and figured she'd rent for a while until she got the lay of the land.
I went on some renter's website and I saw some great homes for what I thought were unbelievable prices.
Then she stumbled onto the catch.
It asked questions like, do you have nice furniture? And I thought, wonder why they're asking that.
The constant threat of showings doesn't really bother this family of three. They're hardly here. The oldest daughter is a competitive gymnast with out-of-town meets every other weekend.
So for us, it works because we are extremely busy.
Other home managers are divorced dads or even professional athletes. For companies that do this live-in staging, it's a booming business right now. Show Homes reports record growth in 6 of the last 7 years. And increasingly, new business is coming from banks, which have historically been stingy property owners.
We have no emotional ties to properties as a bank.
Jason West disposes of foreclosed properties for Pinnacle Financial Partners, based in Nashville. It's one of the 22 banks spread from Maryland to California that have started using show homes over the last 2 years. For financial institutions, West says selling a home is just a numbers game.
And you say, okay, is there a benefit for having the home occupied? And is the cost of staging going to either shorten my sales cycle or get me a higher price?
If the answer is yes, West says live-in staging makes sense, as unusual as it sounds, particularly if the home sits on a block with half a dozen other empty places. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Allianz, providing investment, insurance, and retirement solutions through its affiliated companies in the U.S. since 1896. AllianzUSA.com. By Constant Contact Email Marketing, providing small businesses and nonprofits with personal coaches to help them succeed. ConstantContact.com. And by Putnam Investments. You can ask your financial advisor about Putnam 529 for America or visit Putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, again from Abbottabad, Pakistan. The Twitterverse lit up last night with word of bin Laden's death, but today one Twitter account stands out. A man who goes by the handle Really Virtual went from less than 1,000 followers yesterday to, as of late afternoon Eastern Time, more than 72,000 and rising fast. Why? He live-tweeted the raid on bin Laden's hideout without even knowing it. The IT consultant had first expressed annoyance at the helicopters flying over his city and his home. Now he can't keep up with all the social media requests flying at him. "I am just a tweeter, awake at the time of the crash," he tweeted today. Not many Twitter users in Abbottabad. These guys are more into Facebook. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 3 points, less than 0.1%. The Nasdaq shaved off 9 points, 0.3%. And the S&P 500 took off 2 points, 0.1%. Our producers include Abishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this show,
the odds of having a son or daughter that are as driven as the founder of a business was, I think, are incredibly small.
In the next installment of Freakonomics Radio, why succession maybe shouldn't be a family affair. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong.
New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.